TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Authoritarian Absurdity of the U.S. Constitution, Part 2 of 2, Paul Street on Why It Matters Today. In late March 2019, an extraordinary analysis of the history of the U.S. Constitution arrived from Chicago via radio station WZRD. The talk by Paul Street was so well researched and irreverent and timely that I already produced the first 25 minutes for TUC Radio, and here now is the conclusion. Paul Street is an independent, radical democratic policy researcher, teacher, journalist, historian, and author of 7 books. He spoke at the Open University of the Left in Chicago. He's addressing the question so many are now asking out loud. What is the current status of American democracy that allows the Trump administration to have come to power? And why are many of their policy decisions so difficult to challenge? In part one of this talk, Paul Street began by setting up arguments and proof that the U.S. Constitution is not the sacred document protecting the people's rights, but on the contrary, is authoritarian and anti-democratic by design. He started his talk about the Constitution by defining how he sees the current conditions. Paul Street.
We do live in an insane historical moment, if you don't mind me saying so. Inequality so extreme now that 3 absurdly rich people possess as much wealth between them as the bottom half of the population in the U.S. Economic power so concentrated that you can count on one hand the multi-trillion dollar financial institutions that control the nation's economic and political assets. 6 corporations together own more than half U.S. print electronic media. 3 internet giants, Google, Facebook, Amazon, rule online communications and shopping. The presidency held by a malignant, narcissist, creeping fascist, pseudo-billionaire most of the nation hates. He pretends to be a populist while doing everything he can to distribute wealth, power further upward.
That was the introduction to Paul Street's Open University talk, given in Chicago on March 23rd, 2019. He then began to systematically analyze the different institutions and procedures embedded by the Founding Fathers in the U.S. Constitution that today prevent oversight, control, and correction, of course, by the people. In the first part of this talk, Paul Street called out the system of rigidly fixed, steeply time-staggered elections that are limiting the possibility of laboring people influencing policy. 2 years for the House, 6 years for the Senate, 4 years for the presidency prevents sweeping changes and all at once popular electoral rebellions. Also, the Founding Fathers created a Supreme Court appointed for life by the president and confirmed by the Senate that is patterned after the British House of Lords. And Paul Street reported how astounded people in other democratic countries are at the curious U.S. system of the Electoral College that guarantees that the popular majority would not directly select the U.S. president. And in the U.S., Street says, we're down to just 15 states who actually have a presidential election, because with winner takes all in blue or red states, all the electoral votes are going to that color. That's a recap of part one. And here is historian and author Paul Street picking up from part one of his talk on the authoritarian absurdity of the U.S. Constitution and why it matters today. Paul Street.
And the Electoral College system just gives us absurdly outsized weight to disproportionately white and white-leaning rural states. And of course, it just openly violates the core democratic principles of majority rule and one person, one vote. Now, when I agreed a while back to come back and do this topic on this date, I thought, well, that'll be fun because I want to talk about this, but it's going to be, I like to work off the news cycle. It's going to be completely off the news cycle, you know? And then actually, this last couple of weeks, the Democratic presidential candidates have started bitching about the Electoral College, interestingly enough. And so it's not completely outside of the news cycle. And it's been fascinating to watch cable news and see right-wing Republican experts come up, because that's what you do in cable news. You get the Democrat over here and the Republican over there, and that's the whole spectrum, the right and the left. And to actually see the right-wing Republican guys actually get up there and just say flat out, we're not a democracy, and the founders didn't want us to be, and we shouldn't be. And the funny thing about it is that the line from Trump and the Republicans is that thanks to the Electoral College, there's an election in the whole country. That's what they say. They go, the small states would be completely, you know, ignored, and we'd only focus on the big cities. And it's just complete nonsense. It's the exact opposite. They're saying 2 + 2 = 5 there. That because of the Electoral College and its winner-take-all electoral system and the partisan geographic polarization of the states now, where you can just write them off, we actually have a presidential election in 15 states at most. The Senate, I love the Senate apportionment system. It's even more skewed to the right. And I'm talking about this, every state gets 2 senators no matter what population they have. It's just Monty Python-esque. It's darkly humorous. The 2% of Americans who live in the nation's 9 smallest states have the same amount of senatorial representation as the 51% of Americans who live in the nation's 9 largest states. Red Wyoming, I love this, home to 573,720 people, holds U.S. senatorial parity with Blue California, where more than 39 American millions reside. That's one senator for every 19.5 million Californians versus one senator for every 278,000 Wyomingians. What's a Wyomingian? I don't know. Let's say a Wyoming resident. A Wyomingian. Talk about a rotten borough system. You know, they still have rotten boroughs in the British House of Lords. Speaking of boroughs, just one of New York City's 5 boroughs, Brooklyn, slated to be home of the Left Forum this year, has 2.6 million people. If Brooklyn, one of New York City's 5 boroughs, were a state and U.S. senators were apportioned there at the same population to senator ratio as Wyoming, Brooklyn would have 9 U.S. senators. And I'm thinking in Brooklyn, it's unlikely that a single one of them would be a Republican. Now, the same goes for Chicago, which is home to 2.7 million people. You know, Brooklyn and Chicago are like the same size. The Chicago metropolitan area is 9.5 million people. If it enjoyed Wyoming's population to senator ratio, Chicagoland would have 17 U.S. senators. I mean, think about that. That'd be like one person, one vote, right? Which is like one of the core elementary baseline definitions of democracy is one person, one vote. I'll get even crazier here. The following 13 states have a combined population of 34.4 million. Alaska, Arizona, Arkansas, Idaho, Iowa, Kansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Nebraska, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Utah, and good old Wyoming. Together, these 13 red states send 26 Republicans to the U.S. Senate. Now, granted, those numbers are before the last midterm elections. I did crunch those numbers before that. There might be I might be one off. I doubt it, though. The single state of California with a population more than 5 million higher than those 13 states combined, of course, sends 2 Democratic senators to our House of Lords, the U.S. Senate. This apportionment system means that the Republican Senate majority answers to a very disproportionately white, rural, and reactionary section of the electorate, and due to a population shift from the agricultural interior to crowded corridors along the coast, it is now at least mathematically possible to cobble together a Senate majority with states that account for just 17.6% of the popular vote. I mean, that's just insane. from a democratic perspective. It's not insane from a right-wing oligarchic perspective. And, you know, don't think that Donald Trump isn't getting a significant part of his agenda through. Not all of it. You know, everything's been Russia now for so long that we forget about all the other shit that's going on. And the handing over of the federal bench and the staffing of the federal judiciary, not to mention the Supreme Court, by the right-wing Federalist Society is a legacy that's going to be with us for a very long time. And who is in charge of passing judgment on Supreme Court appointments? Just the U.S. Senate, not the House. And that U.S. Senate is absurdly overrepresentative of the red state, white nationalist, Republican, rural heartland. Now, in some nations operating with parliamentary systems, terrible, awful, disgusting, revolting, narcissistic, dysfunctional, proto-fascistic presidents or prime ministers can be compelled by votes of no confidence and the like to call or accede to new national elections. Wouldn't that be something? A vote of no confidence. We have no confidence in this malignant fascist creep. That's half new elections, right? Such an action is unthinkable in the United States. The Holy Founders, the Holy Constitution, says that qualified voters get to select presidents, well, indirectly, we don't even directly elect presidents, once every 4 years. We can select U.S. senators once every 6 years, and House representatives once every 2 years, and that's the way it is, and if you don't like it, sit down and shut up, Simon says. I once realized I might be living in an authoritarian society when I was about 5 years old and I first played the game, Simon says, right? It's the stupidest game ever invented. Yeah, a kid says, step over the line, and you step over the line and go, no, you shouldn't have done that. I'm supposed to say Simon says first. Oh, okay. Simon says, put your finger in your nose. Oh, very good, you did it. I mean, what is that? You know, that's kind of how we are with the Constitution. I remember once I was sitting in a coffee shop in Iowa City and two University of Iowa law students were looking up for their law books and they had just read some Supreme Court decision. And the one looked at the other and said, you know, we've made like gods out of these guys wearing powdered wigs in the late 18th century, you know, when the Bourbons sat atop France. They're like holy lords or something like that. As Simon says, as George W. Bush's White House spokesperson Dana Perino explained in March of 2008, when a journalist asked her if the citizenry should have input on U.S. foreign policy, you know, like every day, like between elections. Dana Perino said, well, you had your input. The American people have input every 4 years. And that's the way our system is set up. Cheney said something like that, too, you know? I'm not driven by polls. I don't care what people think. We were elected. Well, but Perino and Cheney were on strong constitutional ground. Pathetically enough, constitutional Simon says you get to select a president indirectly in a voting booth for 2 minutes or so once every 1,400 days. Well, except you don't actually vote for the president. The Electoral College does. And it's already a done deal in all but 12 to 15 of the states before you walk in the voting booth, but you get the idea. You get to vote for a U.S. House member. Usually, by the way, and I didn't have time to go into gerrymandering, which isn't in the Constitution. There's nothing that mandates gerrymandering in the U.S. Constitution. But you get to vote for a U.S. House member, usually in a heavily gerrymandered district for a few minutes, once every 730 days. You get to vote for each of your U.S. senators once every 1,095 days. You don't vote for Supreme Court justices. The president, for whom you don't vote directly, appoints them, subject to approval from the Senate, which absurdly overrepresents the rural and white populace. That's how you get a serial abuser like Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court for life. Supremes are appointed for life, which is like a really, really long time. Well, it can be. It's why we're so desperate to, you know, everything to people, liberals, and I mean, even me, to anything. If we just keep Ruth Bader Ginsburg alive long enough to not have a fascist president to replace her. Now, it's true that malignant presidents like Trump can be constitutionally impeached by the House and removed by the Senate, but the barriers to removal are very steep. And again, that's on purpose. It's never happened, though. Richard Nixon would certainly have been impeached and removed had he not resigned. He resigned after the moment when Senator Barry Goldwater went in and told him, we've got the votes in the Senate. So, I mean, you know, in effect, Nixon was a de facto impeachment and removal. But the barriers are very, very steep. It's never actually happened except kind of for Nixon. Full defenestration of a president, no matter how awful that president are, requires a two-thirds vote in the absurdly unrepresentative Senate. And of course, the Senate right now is under the Republicans. But what would impeachment and removal give us under the revered, holy U.S. Constitution anyway? The presidency of the arch right-wing Republican Mike Pence. You think Trump is scary? Pence is a Christian white nationalist fascist under whose rule the hard right agenda that most of the populace hates might be advanced more effectively than it is under Trump. Don't like it? Too bad. The Constitution says that's how it is. So, suck it up, Buttercup. Get back in shape for the next strictly time-staggered, constitutionally mandated, quadrennial, candidate-centered electoral extravaganza to vote a Democrat into the White House? Really? Why bother? The Democrats are every bit as corporatized and sold out to the financial plutocracy and its military empire, to the capitalist system that emerged out of national development under the rule of the propertied elite that the holy founders worked so hard to protect. Every bit as captive to and sold out to and owned by that system as the Republicans. And they are that way, thanks in part to the outrageously outsized role of big money campaign contributions in the nation's politics, in its ever more absurdly expensive elections. And that role of money, the role of campaign finance, the role of the wealth primary, so to speak, in our electoral process, is traceable at least in part to the U.S. Constitution. The founding finaglers created the Supreme Court as a critical, appointed for life, check on the popular will. And in two landmark decisions that took place in the lifetime of everybody in this room, I think. Everybody, I'm looking around. In the Buckley-Valeo decision, 1976, and the Citizens United decision of 2010, the High Court has ruled that private campaign contributions are free speech, and that there are no constitutional limits that can be set on how much the rich and the powerful can invest in the giant organized bribery project that is U.S. campaign finance. Don't like it. Too bad. The Supreme Court and the Constitution says. Want to form a politically relevant, more genuinely progressive and egalitarian third party beyond the radically regressive and reactionary Republicans and the dismal dollar-drenched Democrats? Hope the Founders' Holy Charter is not on your side. It encourages winner-take-all, first-past-the-post elections tied to specific geographical districts. There's no provision in it for proportional representation to accommodate and create room for third or fourth parties that are never ready at the first election that they roll out their agendas to compete and win pluralities in American elections. You don't like it, neither do I, neither do most Americans. Most Americans forever have told pollsters that the two big money major parties do not adequately represent the actual spectrum of political opinion in this country. And again, so what? Who cares? Too bad. Simon says, sit down and shut up. So what is to be done? Everything. Everything is still to be done. You don't have to have a decent constitution in place to engage in class struggle and the fight for the common good. The Bolsheviks didn't need a good constitution. There wasn't any constitution at all to make the Russian Revolution in 1917. Electoral politics, constitutional interventions and congressional investigations and Mueller reports are not the only or even the leading politics that matter or ought to matter most to a real functioning left. Take to the streets, occupy workplaces, idle capital, besiege corporate headquarters, protest corporate media, sabotage pipelines, monkey wrench ecocide, defend immigrants, provide sanctuary, form grassroots movements, learn how to build barricades, put on a yellow vest, become a gilet jaune, stop traffic, transcend sectarianism, form a movement culture that makes movements fun again, engage in civil disobedience, join the Extinction Rebellion, get real about the state of the world, hold workshops on what capitalism and industrialism are doing to livable ecology, form community permacultural gardens, resist the racist police. People are doing this. None of this stops being essential because the nation is absurdly beholden to an absurd parchment from the time when the nation was ruled by slave owners and merchant capitalists wearing powdered wigs. That said, we ought, like the Gilets Jaunes in France, to be calling for a new national government and a new national charter. Around the planet, national constitutions actually do not generally last all that long. As Zachary Elkins, Thomas Ginsburg, and James Melton note in their book, The Endurance of National Constitutions, it sounds like the title of their book actually ought to be The Non-Endurance of National Constitutions, quote, "The mean lifespan of constitutions across the world since 1789, French Revolution, is 17 years. Since World War I, the average lifespan of a constitution, they say, is 12 years. And I'm not saying we should be rewriting constitutions every 2 months either. I mean, that can get dysfunctional as well. But the U.S. is just ridiculously different. It's just off the charts the other way. It's absurdly venerated, purposefully democracy-disabling constitution has remained in place with occasional amendments for 230-plus years. We've bowed down and prayed to the fetishized, explicitly, openly anti-democratic U.S. Constitution for way too long. We deserve something much better, to be drafted by people's representatives elected to a constituent assembly, empowered to write a new national charter that would be dedicated to the introduction and the preservation of our holy founder's ultimate nightmare, popular sovereignty. We can talk about some of what might be included in such a new national charter. Curiously enough, that has actually emerged in the Gilets Jaunes movement. There's an explicit call for a Sixth Republic in France and for a rejection of the fetish of so-called bourgeois representationalism and a call for direct democracy. Imagine that. And isn't it amazing how monumentally invisible the French protests have been in American media? And in fact, when they were peaking in December and November, I swear, this doesn't surprise me actually, I saw more footage from France. This is incredible footage. This is a country that shares a lot of Western civilizational history in the United States. It has a seat on the United Nations Security Council. This is a big deal nation, France. They're a nuclear power, both in terms of nuclear energy and nuclear weapons. Undergoing a prolonged mass, damn near proto-revolutionary movement in the streets for week after week after week. And it was barely covered on cable news, on CNN and MSNBC. And I saw more of it on Fox, because Fox kind of liked it because they hate Macron, because they paint him out as some sort of leftist, which is, of course, completely absurd. He's a neoliberal in the mode of the Clintons and the Obamas. And it was sparked by a fuel tax. And the Trumpies loved that because then they wanted to frame the Gilets Jaunes as really being against the environmental agenda, which was bullshit because, in fact, what the Gilets Jaunes, many of them are environmentalists, what they were objecting to was the regressive nature of the fuel tax was disproportionately imposed on these working class people who have to commute to work at ever increasing distances from French cities because of gentrification in France. And also it was a tax that had come in the wake of the repeal of the famous social wealth tax in France too. In other words, they were saying, why should we have to disproportionately pay for efforts to stem climate change? Turns out they're not anti-climate. They're not against healing the planet. But in any event, not even on the radar screen of our media. I'm trying to remember at the time Gilets Jaunes was going on, what was obsessing national media at the time. Oh, there was the shutdown stuff. Yeah, we were all about the shutdown stuff. And of course, we've been obsessed about Russia. You would think there's just nothing but Russia's alleged oligarchic overthrow of our purported democracy for just about the last 2 years, right? You know, I did a paper on Truth Digger, I think it was Counterpunch somewhere. It's like, who will save our democracy from the oligarchs? The American oligarchs. the American oligarchy. And anyway, I thought I'd throw all that in there. There's nothing wrong with saying that, you know, that it's grim. One thing I like about this Extinction Rebellion group, which has come up, is that they reject, and they do this in kind of a spiritual Buddhist existential kind of way, they reject the false dichotomies of hope and fear, this future orientation. We always have to stay hopey, changey, and happy. No, the old left-wing slogan, don't mourn, organize, is bullshit. I don't want to be organized by anybody that doesn't know how to mourn. Properly mourn the situation we're in. Deal with it. And then get real about where we are. That's where actual action that might matter begins. And the ER slogan is hope dies, action begins. And I actually like that. Because we live in the present moment. And hope and fear, but both take us out of it. The earth is our witness. The real world that we're living in, where livable ecology is now seriously in danger. And human extinction is something we can actually talk about by 2100. Deal with that and then get serious and operate from there.
That was the conclusion of a talk by Paul Street, an independent, radical democratic policy researcher, teacher, journalist, historian, and author of 7 books. Among his books are The Empire's New Clothes, Barack Obama in the Real World of Power, and Crashing the Tea Party, Mass Media and the Campaign to Remake American Politics. Paul Street's essays and commentaries have appeared in Counterpunch, Truth Dig, Black Agenda Report, the Chicago Tribune, the New York Times, and CNN, among others. He spoke on March 23rd, 2019, at the Open University of the Left in Chicago. Credit for the recording of Paul Street goes to Dale Lehman of WZRD Radio in Chicago. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening.